suggest is follow-up is standard in the industry. We're talking about sales in this particular case of home air conditioning equipment. We're actually in sales of any expensive equipment, along with
follow-up wasn't the only thing. It was follow-up in context of a lot of other statements that appeared in the same order.
Is ask permission to ask questions. Build that difference between persistent and pushing. All of these statements were claimed to be copyrighted and copied by Hamlin in his publication from the Act publication. Rules for asking questions. Start with open-ended question. All of these were in the testimony at trial. Served to be common standard statements, comments, phrases used in this industry, the industry of training salesmen of air conditioning equipment. Jim Hamlin testified that these were all common phrases. Mr. Howard, the president of ACT, confirmed that all except the one were not original with him, that they were all standard, common in the industry, had been for 25, 30 years. And the only one he said that he originated, in fact, was follow-up, follow-up, follow-up. That, he also testified, was, in fact, by the time that Mr. Hamlin created his materials, common and standard phrasing in the industry, had been for at least 25 years, according to his testimony. So every phrase that we're talking about in this case is a phrase was common standard in the industry. One of the issues here is that the trial court, did not instruct the jury, as he had been requested, that common standard phrases are not subject to copyright protection.
So how does the instruction that the trial court gave on originality fall short of what you think the jury needed to have in order to make a proper determination?
It doesn't go so far as to say, for example, in this case, Mr. Howard testified that he, on behalf of the ACT, created follow-up, follow-up, follow-up. The jury could easily say that it's copyrightable because it is not, because they're not instructed that even though it became a standard phrase in the industry, that it was not protected by copyright.
But they were told that ideas couldn't be copyrighted. I mean, they were told that ideas and concepts can't be copyrighted. And then they looked at these documents that didn't just have some phrases, but had them in the same order and the same context. So I guess I'm struggling with both things. How is that not covered by ideas, first of all? And then second of all, how is it not in some way harmless? Because that's not really what the documents, that's not the only issue in these documents anyway.
Well, the issue in these documents is not, that's not the only issue. But that was certainly the issue that was presented to the jury. That is that these phrases are what makes Hamlin's materials infringing on ACT's materials. It's these phrases, and that's what the jury was told to focus on.
Who told them that? Who told them to focus on?
ACT's counsel throughout the trial. That was the argument, that was what was questioned of the witnesses, and that was what was argued to the jury, was that these phrases are all copied from each other, even though if you look at each phrase in each material, they're phrased differently, they appear differently, they convey similar ideas, no question about it, but those are common standard in the industry. What the jury here was allowed to do was to take something like follow-up, 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 and say, well, that's a copyright infringement. But in fact, it's not, because it's because copyright protection does not apply to those kinds of phrases to common standard.
Why wouldn't they have excluded under the instruction that says you need originality? Oh, why wouldn't they have looked at that instruction and said, this is not?
It just doesn't go far enough. Even though, for example, Mr. Howard said, I originated follow, follow, follow him. It was, by the time it was ever used by Mr. Hamlin, common standard stock in the industry. The jury wasn't told that. The jury was simply said, if it's original, and Mr. Howard said, well, it's original with me, then we can say that that's infringing. They weren't told that once it becomes standard, common stock in the industry, it's not protected by copyright.
The copyright is lost.
The copyright is lost once it becomes standard or stock in the industry, yes.
You can't copyright the order and the presentation of these phrases that are common.
The expression of these ideas can't be copyrighted.
Isn't that what the allegation here was? The materials were basically listed, isn't it?
That's what the allegation was, but if you look at the phrases, they're different. They are different.
That's the extent of difference, the weight to be given to the difference, the probativeness, isn't that what the jury had before it? And they also had the other factor, which was access to the copyrighted work, which obviously he had.
Yes, he had access.
He admitted he had it when he produced it, when he developed his own competing manual.
Access was not an issue. Access was conceded before the jury. There's no question that Mr. Hamlin had access to hacks and materials, but he didn't copy them. He used similar ideas in many cases, rephrased them in most cases. The phrasing is different in each
of them. Is there a list somewhere that shows the different phrases and how they compare?
I do.
Where is going to find that?
It's in the brief.
Okay, where?
There is a, on page 22 and 23 of our opening brief, the hacked expressions are on one side, the Hamlin expressions are on the other, and they are different. They express similar ideas, but they are phrased differently. That makes them non-infringing. You can convey the ideas because the ideas cannot be copyrighted. The systems cannot be copyrighted. One of the things that Mr. Mueller testified to in his testimony, Mr. Mueller was his general manager, was that, yes, we are trying to protect the process. This is a process, and that's what we want to protect.
Do you dispute anything about the presentation on pages 11 through 13 of their brief, the red brief?
I don't have that with me. But I do, and I think I did.
I'm bringing the briefs with you.
I have my brief. I have it in my computer. I have not printed it out.
Think you came unprepared to court?
No offense.
Looks like it.
Yeah. But those pages have rules for asking questions compared to the two with the list. They follow, follow, follow up with the list underneath. I mean, do you remember those pages? Do you dispute anything about how they show the same points in the same order in the same list?
They're not presented. If you look at the whole picture, their publication, Hamlin's publication, you look at where they are, how they're presented in those publications, they're different. Even the phrasing in some of those phrases is different. The punctuation is different. The words are different. They're similar, and they're close, but they are not exactly the same.
Is there any real possibility that someone could create the Hamlin materials without having thought about the works or seen it? I mean, it's just random. You end up with the same list with slightly different words, but basically the same points in the same order over and over.
Absolutely.
How would that happen?
Mr. Hamlin was teaching this material for 30 years.
Right.
These are phrases
he had from using their materials.
Well, he used Hamlin in his head long before he ever saw their materials.
How do we know that?
He testified to that, and it was not disputed. Justified that he'd been using these phrases for 30 years. He'd been working for ACT for something less than 10 years. He knew these phrases. This is what he had taught. That's why he was not employed, but contracted with ACT. Because he was good at this.
Well, I'd say the jury didn't believe that and thought what he did is he took realists and jumbled the words and would come up with slightly different phrasing. Would that be infringement?
Infringement is different, no, it would not be an infringement. The copyright protects the expression of an idea. It does not protect the idea of the concept or the process.
So you can take a novel and change a few words and print it again, and it's not the same, it's not the same expression. I mean, that's what kids do to make fake homework, right? They change one word out of five, and then everything else is the same. That's not plagiarism.
It depends on how much it's changed, what's changed, and why it's changed. I mean, you have to look at it, and the jury had to look at it in this case. The problem here was that the jury was not told that common, everyday expressions, stock expressions, are not subject to copyright. So they're looking at all of this, and they are not told what the restrictions and the limitations of the copyright protection are. And that was the problem.
Let's say we think that the instructions were not an abuse of discretion. Do you have a sufficient evidence argument
I did argue the sufficiency of the evidence, and that sort of tied in with all this. Yes. Yes, it is in the brief. The sufficiency of the evidence. And we talk about the differences between Hamlin's production and Max's production.
Where is that? Since you don't have your brief, where's the point on the home pages? It's page 17.
Page 17. It begins on page 17. I do want to address a couple of other points. And one is the disclosures in this case. Plaintiff was allowed to use witnesses, exhibits, without any disclosure in this case.
In your writing, have you indicated any prejudice to you from the rulings that the trial court made, which limited all of the ACT evidence to what had been already produced in summary judgment or in the discovery?
That was a limitation that was requested by Waterford, which was in the case at the time. It was not requested by me. I did not argue with that. The court had ruled on that. The prejudice was that ultimately the court said when we objected to Exhibit 121, which was an exhibit, it was used by ACT to establish their damage claim. We objected to that because it had never been disclosed. And the trial court said, you take the weekend, go home, get your materials, come back, and see what you can do. It was, but it was never disclosed as anything that was ever going to be used in a trial.
But the judge said the things that came out in depositions were disclosed enough that you knew they were an issue, and those are the only things we're going to let you use.
He did not. There's no way we could know that was an issue because it's never been disclosed as something that would be used to support any of the claims in this case. It came out in a document production of some 50,000 documents. The document comes to Waterford sometime before trial. And it was used in Albertson's deposition, but so were a lot of other things. There were over 50,000 documents in this case.
The judge thought that if it was an exhibit in a deposition, that it was adequate notice that it was an issue. So I guess you just disagree with that, but can we say that's an abuse of discretion?
That did not raise an issue. That was simply a question on discovery. Discovery and disclosure are different things. The disclosure rules require the disclosure of certain things. Among those things, the identity of witnesses. Two of the witnesses that testified at trial were never disclosed as witnesses. The subject matter of all the witnesses, none of which was ever disclosed by the plaintiffs. The exhibits that are going to be used.
So is the prejudice only Exhibit 121 that it answered into the charter discussion?
121 and 22 on documents, testimony of two witnesses, which is Mr. Albertson and Mrs. Howard, neither of whom had ever been disclosed.
But they were deposed, right? And they were limited to what they'd been deposed on?
Mrs. Howard had been deposed, and she was limited. That's correct. It does not tell us how to prepare for trial because we don't know what's going to be used in trial. She was never disclosed as a trial witness until the final pretrial statement. The disclosure rules in Rule 37 says if you don't disclose it, you can't use it. It's a self-executing rule and simply says if it's not there, you don't use it. This court has said the same thing. All I'm asking here is that the court enforce that, which the court said it was going to enforce.
Can I ask you a question about your counterclaim?
Yes.
Why is there federal jurisdiction over your counterclaim?
It is the ancillary jurisdiction.
So how does it share a common nucleus of facts with the copyright claim? It seems like they're totally different facts. One is about advertising photos and one is about marketplace and trading.
It all comes out of the same relationship.
Are they the same facts about the relationship then?
No, they're not.
So would these kind of claims commonly be tried together?
Yes.
Why?
Because I think it's a mandatory counterclaim.
Why?
Because it comes out of that. It's the claims between the same people and the same relationship. But it was not.
Any similar case where really quite different aspects of an employment relationship had to be tried together?
Frankly, I haven't looked at that issue because it never was an issue before the trial court. The trial court did not dismiss the counterclaim on the basis, on that kind of a basis at all. Simply dismissed the counterclaim on summary judgment on the basis that it was incidental and on the basis of economic damages.
And there was no economic harm even claimed by Mr.
There was not. There was not. And Arizona law in the Reed case says you don't need economic harm. You don't need special damages under Arizona law to make a claim for invasion of privacy.
But this was an invasion of privacy, right? It was a corporate, what's the name of this claim? Isn't it I'm forgetting the name of your claim, but isn't it not invasion of privacy?
It is invasion of privacy.
I thought it commercial publicity or something. Isn't it a different claim?
That is an invasion of privacy claim. No. If you look at the Reed case and the later case that was cited.
So what do you do with Reynolds?
Reynolds, also Reynolds. Yeah.
So it's Reynolds that you need to have show that there's a commercial injury.
No. Reynolds said nothing about that. Reynolds did not overrule Reed. Made no comment about economic damages that Reed did. Made no attempt to overrule Reed. And simply affirmed the dismissal of the plaintiff's case in that case because the plaintiff made a type of a claim, not economic damages, that was specifically permitted under the statutes.
You have less than a minute left. Do you want to save it?
I'll save it. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Maria Smith, and I'm here on behalf of the ACT Group. I will be addressing the copyright issues, and then I will defer the last 10 minutes to my colleague, Jesse Showalter, who will address the counterclaim and the right of publicity claim. Nine jurors in this case unanimously determined that Jim Havlin willfully infringed ACT Group's copyrighted materials, and there are no grounds to disturb that verdict.
I get a number of grounds.
Yes.
So, why isn't there an insufficiency argument? Either a copyright protects expression, not meaning, right?
Correct. be entitled to go through and create a new work with new phrasing. That's not what happened, Your Honor. The original book was a thick book this big. This was the Acrid materials. And in some cases, entire pages of Mr. Hallin's materials, the entire page, were verbatim from this book. And so one example of that, Your Honor, and you know, Mr. Helms talks about follow-up, follow-up, follow-up. That entire slide, Your Honor, which is ER-1795, from beginning to get to end, every single word on that slide comes ER-1795. Yes, 1,795. And you flip back and forth between ER-1795, which is Mr. Hallin's materials, and then the Act Group materials, what you will see is although not...
Flip back and forth, you gave me one page.
Oh, yeah, the first page was 1795 is the Hallin materials.
1795, mm-hmm. And what is the other page?
1893. Although Mr. Hallin doesn't take every word from the Act Group page.
The Finnish material in 1893.
Yeah, and, no, that's the plaintiff's material. Act Group is
the... So this is Act Group, water furnace.
Water furnace is Mr. Hallin's material.
So I'm confused. That's why I'm confused, because it says 1893. Water furnace, I thought that was his stuff.
I have 1795 as worse, so I have it backwards. Yeah, you do. I apologize. I may have it backwards. So the one that starts off is you don't close.
The actual page was number 7.
I was, and when I looked at the actual pages, I must have written them down backwards. I have them here. The one I have has the dates over at the bottom. Will that help us? So they both have ACT date numbers.
I have ACT date numbers. So now we are now looking at whose materials.
So what I want to compare is I want to compare Mr. Hamlet's materials to Tarsu.
Okay, I am now talking about
two things.
Tell me whose material you first want to talk about. So we're on the same page.
Right. So now I'm concerned that my number's wrong, but I had ER-1893 as...
Okay, I asked you a question.
Mm-hmm.
Plaintiff or defendant?
Okay, so...
I see one of those two things.
The plaintiff's materials?
Okay, plaintiff's materials, and you think that's on page what?
1893
is something that says water furnace on the sideways page. This is water furnace.
Then perhaps 1795, maybe I have them backwards.
Do you actually look at the page? Do you have the page?
I had it. I have it on the computer, Your Honor.
Okay. 1795 is a page that goes...
That goes...
Portrait, and it goes, if you don't close...
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. That's plaintiff's materials. 1795 is plaintiff's materials.
Your client's materials.
Correct.
Okay.
And then 1893, that says water furnace at the bottom, is Mr. Hamlin's materials. Yes, unless you look at the words, Your Honor. I agree that they look different, but if you look, it says if you don't close, get a commitment. But if you look at a little further down the page, every single...
Further down which page?
On 1795. It says follow up, follow up, follow up. That's on 1893, follow up, follow up, follow up.
Okay.
The next thing that's on there, know the difference between being persistent and being pushy. That's verbatim on Mr. Hamlin's materials.
Okay. And he leaves out persistent people who always have a reason to come back.
Correct. He doesn't take everything. That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Call whenever there is new information. Verbatim, call when there is new information. Or not verbatim. One says when and one says whenever. Don't send additional information, drop it by. Don't send additional information, drop it by the house. Both have the drop it by in quotes. Follow up is your responsibility, not your customer's.
Quotes, the previous one omits quotes. So if you want quotes to count,
well,
you want the S, then you have to discount it entirely.
Fair.
You can't sort of add it to one of them.
Well, he did. He grabbed the quotes on one and he didn't on the other. Okay. Well, I think it's interesting that drop it by is in quotes on both when I don't know why that would be in quotes other than it was copied. Also, follow up to your That is true. Follow up is your responsibility, not your customers. Follow up is your responsibility, not your customers. So, Your Honor, my point is every single thing on Mr. Hamlin's slide comes exactly.
He misspells customers.
He does. He does. It leaves out the apostrophe. That is correct, Your Honor. So that error he didn't get from us. He made that one on his own. Your Honor, that's just one example. There's another slide that's ER 1750. That is for
verbatim. It seems relatively few things on this page are copied.
Your Honor, every single thing on Mr. Hamlin's page is copied from our page. Every single thing. None of it is original. I understand that if you look at the act group first, what you see is that there are other things that he didn't copy. There's no requirement that he copy everything. Everything that he used, he got from us. Same thing on the slide from ER 1750.
What are the things that he missed on page
23? Sure. What he did was he took phrases that were somewhat different and highlighted those, as a good advocate would do, and ignored the verbatim copying. But if you look at our brief, Your Honor, you'll see page after page, at page 17 on, of verbatim copy. It's at page 11 on, and side by side, side by side, side by side. So,
page
11, 12, and 13 in our brief, Your Honor. So, certainly, a reasonable jury had sufficient and substantial evidence by which it could found and find that there was copyright infringement, and it did. Your Honor, the appellant also raises the issue of the insufficiency of the jury instruction. And the jury instruction that Mr. Hamlin wanted about common soft phrases.
Right, I'm on the list of page 13.
Sure.
Since I cannot prepare the copies, I'll change to some extent. At least on the same pages and pages of copying. I mean, for example, three people buy from those they like and agree with. He has people buy from people they like and trust.
Correct. He changed that. No doubt, Your Honor, that he changed something.
He changed the meaning.
I'm not sure if it matters if he changed the meaning because it's not the idea that's protected, it's the expression. But he did change the expression.
He changed the words in a way that also changed the meaning. One of them is like, the other is trust.
But whether or not he took the idea is not something that I'm here to argue about. He is allowed to take the ideas. The law is very, very clear that he can take the ideas, but he cannot take the expressions. And copyright law requires that you take constituent original elements. It does not require that you copy all of it. And we never have contended that he's copied all of it.
How are these just stock phrases? Because the title of the instruction is stock phrases.
Right. And, Your Honor, this case is not about stock phrases. It's about taking entire pages of his materials from our materials, page after page after page. It's not about...
But if all of those things are stock phrases to come from the public domain, you can't keep copyright on
them. Every word comes from the public domain. It's the way that we string them together that gives us copyright protection. And the way that Act Group strung these words together is what was copied and why there was an infringement and why the jury determined that there was an infringement. And, Your Honor, I see I have only 8 minutes left for Mr. Showalter to address the counterclaim. And I want to obviously honor your and respect your wishes here, but if I don't also want to step on Mr. Showalter's toes. So if I can turn it, unless you have more questions about the copyright, if I can turn it over to Mr. Showalter to address the counterclaim. Or do you want me to address another question?
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Jesse Showalter, representing ACT, arguing for ACT with respect to the counterclaim. The district court correctly granted summary judgment on a Dillon's right of publicity counterclaim. And there's two reasons for that. First, and most significantly, the public failed to show any economic damages. And Mr. Helms discussed that, and he says that he doesn't need to because of Reed. Reed's a very different type of claim. And Reynolds makes that clear. In Reynolds, the court says in paragraph 10, the tort of appropriation, and Reynolds says that the right of publicity and the tort of appropriation of likeness for commercial advantage are the same thing. It uses those terms interchangeably. It says the tort of appropriation affords redress of commercial injuries, by contrast, the personal injuries of the sort remedied by a claim for, e.g., invasion of privacy by intrusion or publication of private facts. Reed is that type of claim. It's not a right of publicity claim. It's a... It's hard to tell if you look at Reed. It seems like they're a little bit obscure in what the actual injury was, but it seems to have been a false light invasion of privacy case where a private plaintiff's image was published in a newspaper article relating to a crime, but the court writing, I think, 1937 doesn't make clear what exactly is involved. What is clear is until Reynolds, Arizona never recognized a right to publicity. And so Reynolds is setting forth the scope of the tort.
Do you see this as how I exercise a fancy jurisdiction?
Supplemental jurisdiction? Yes, I do, Your Honor. Sure.
If you conclude you, it isn't easier to take you, isn't it? Then ask for the judgment. And you could go back to state court.
If there was no jurisdiction, that's correct.
So why was the jurisdiction?
Why was the jurisdiction under 1367 supplemental jurisdiction, and this was never briefed or argued? So
jurisdiction is jurisdiction.
Jurisdiction is jurisdiction. You have a duty to make sure you have jurisdiction.
Thank you. Did you come up with this yourself?
Yes.
Is a stock phrase.
I'm sorry, Humphrey, it's very much a stock phrase. The common nucleus here is the separation of these of Mr. Hamlin from the ACT Group. Mr. Hamlin worked for the ACT Group from 2002 as an independent contractor until, I believe, 2011, so 9 years. And it's that that common nucleus of facts is what it has in common.
So that the fact of employment is a common fact, but is there any other common fact? I mean, in one set, we've got these two sets of training materials we have to compare, and in the other, we've got this photo and the ad and whether he had damages. I mean, I really am having trouble seeing how the facts are the same facts.
Well, and I think what the court should understand is I would focus not just on the 9 years, but also on the destruction of the relationship. And so this relationship comes to an end.
It's clear that there's a lot of animosity between these parties, but that's not related to the elements of the claims either, really, right?
No, but that disruption between the two parties, it doesn't make sense from a judicial or economic perspective that any time there's, you see business divorce cases all the time. Every time that happens, it makes economic sense for the courts to understand that disruption as a single event and not to be trying these cases all over multiple jurisdictions, because what could result from that is sort of inconsistent rulings where somebody has to try one case in state court and one case in federal court, and all of a sudden the amounts owed, the issues could have very different results.
Is there any possibility that something about the ruling on the copyright claim and something about the ruling on the advertising claim could be inconsistent?
Well, I think there certainly could. I don't know in this particular case if any overlap between that, but there certainly could have been overlap.
What would that have been? I mean, what could there have been?
Well, what it could have been is you could have read documents in which there's a claim for copyright protection as well as an image of Mr. Hamlin. And there could be some overlap there where the courts are actually looking at the same documents and saying that, for instance,
if his picture was on the training materials, then
exactly.
But that's not the case here, right?
You're right, that's not the case here. But
if there's no possibility because it's in verdicts, there's nothing they say if he could win on the one and lose on the other, vice versa, and there wouldn't be any inconsistency between those judgments.
Well, I don't know that that's the case, but
it's less important what you know. The question is to tell me why that's not true. If you think that's not true.
I think the issue is that,
I know you want to talk about something else, but why don't you tell me what I asked the question about?
And this hasn't been briefed at all, and I'm coming in cold, and I don't have an answer to your question. Don't frame this.
You can't think of anything.
I can't off the top of my head without having looked at the issue.
Is there overlap in timing between the use of this image on the advertising materials and his use of the training manual that was approved and trial to have been infringed?
Absolutely. He left ACT in 2011. It appears that the images remained in use by ACT until 2013.
Well, but that would have been true if they had run away his dog, too. So while he's using his material, the company talks to run away his dog. He would have been contemporaneous, but that doesn't mean much, does it?
I think it's very different here, because what you have here is these two parties whose interests in their intellectual and commercial property are intermeshed because of the contractor relationship, and then that contractor relationship implodes, and they're arguing over the various pieces of that. And so, I'm going to go back to that. It's that there is this 9-year-long relationship.
So what if he claimed, while I was working at ACT, I contracted the contagious disease, it's a working condition, they were careless, and I contracted this contagious, illness, which has now cost me all these health problems. Would that be, sort of a falling problem?
No, I don't think so. I think there would be no overlap there. Why not?
Because one has to do with intellectual property and the other one has to do with...
No, I don't think so at all. I think you have an injury that's completely independent and really unrelated to the relationship. One other thing I'd like to highlight for the court is that when this case was initially brought, there was a pendant state law claim alleging a breach of the duty of loyalty. And so I think that also may have played a part.
What happened to that claim?
I don't know as I stand here before you. I don't know how it was, I don't know if it was dismissed.
A trial by the court. So how is that relevant?
So if there's pendant jurisdiction or something.
duty of loyalty issue about the publicity of the advertising?
No, it was not. It was similar to it was essentially
a state law version of the copyright issue. So that doesn't really help, I think, right? It doesn't bring, the facts of that claim don't sound like they would have any more overlap with the publicity claim than we have with the copyright one.
Well, I think the distinction I'd make is that if the court's already exercising jurisdiction over one pendant state law claim, and then an additional state law counterclaim is brought, again, it goes to the economic efficiencies and the idea that we have this central relationship between the parties that's fractured, and the parties are suing one another over it. It should be handled as a single matter.
Thank you.
How
much time left?
45 seconds.
No, not here. I think it was for you. Sit down.
I think I have not much time left. Let me ask one question. Counsel asked, why did the jury find infringement here? And the fact is, we don't know. We don't know if it was because they found that standard stock phrases infringed on the copyright or not, because they weren't given that instruction not to consider that. That's the problem. The jury also was able to consider witnesses' testimony, exhibits that had never been disclosed. Should not have been allowed in trial.
What evidence was there that these were standard phrases?
I'm sorry?
What evidence was there that these things that you claim were standard phrases?
Testimony of Jim Hamlin said he'd been using these phrases for 30 years. That testimony was confirmed by ACT's president, Mr. Howard. On every one of those that we asked him, was that a standard or stock phrase? He said yes, except for follow-up. He said, I originated that, but it was certainly stock or standard for 25 years before Mr. Hamlin used it. So that testimony was uncontroverted at trial, that these are stock, standard phrases.
So why is that of such critical import when it is the arrangement, the selection, the positioning of those phrases that is determinative or not? There's been copying, recognizing, as the Arizona courts have, that training manuals and maintenance manuals are sufficiently original.
Because if they use stock phrases, those stock phrases are not subject to copyright infringement. That this court has said, and if I pronounce right, Sadova, and is still good. That was in 2003, and has not been questioned since.
So why was ACT's training manual a class challenge?
Not the whole manual, but the stock phrases can be used. The stock phrases are not subject to copyright protection. The entire manual, somebody uses that and says, here, we're going to sell train equipment, which is what most of that manual was all about the sale of train equipment. Completely different than what Hamlin's materials were. If you copy that and say, we're going to sell train equipment using this, that could be an infringement, depending on what and how much was copied. Mr. Hamlin did not do that. If you have other questions, I know I'm out of time, if they have other questions.
I think we're out of time. Thank you for your time. We'll see you soon. Thank you very much.